I'm Kathy Forstie, music director at KC Cafe Radio. Today I have the pleasure of chatting with Americana singer-songwriter Lauren Adams. Lauren has recorded several CDs that showcase her vivid storytelling and songwriting and her gutsy vocals. But in the newest CD, Somewhere Else, she takes those qualities to greater heights with songs written from her heart and soul. Thanks, Lauren, for chatting with me today here on KC Cafe Radio.
Hey, Kathy. Thank you for inviting me. You're happy welcome. To be here.
I love the album Somewhere Else.
Thank you.
Tell me how you decided on that title for the album.
Well, I usually try and pick one of the songs that really stands out to me while we're recording, and I usually name the CD after that. But wanting to always be somewhere else other than where you are, you know, is kind of, I think, a universal feeling sometimes. Sometimes people want to be somewhere else, like Calgon, Take Me Away. But that was the song that I thought stood out the most, and so that's why I named it Somewhere Else.
And the album cover is a really unique album cover. Can you describe that to our listeners and tell us why you chose that?
Yeah, absolutely. Deborah Dobkin, who's also my drummer, and played on the record, one of my drummers, but played most of the songs, I think, is also a graphic artist. And we were talking about maybe having a road going somewhere or, you know, a placement somewhere. And I just started we both just started looking for pictures. So the picture is a sort of a forest scene with a red chair sitting alone by itself, and the colors are really vivid, and I think it's a forest scene. I don't have it in front of me right now, but yeah, that's what I remember.
It's a forest scene, yeah.
yeah, and so it's just like there's no one sitting in the chair. Mm-hmm. Like they've gone somewhere else, or we all want to be somewhere else, or something like that. And then on the inside and the back, there's like a trail that kind of leads off, like a road that kind of leads off into the forest with a light, so... Yeah, it was exciting to do that and get the colors the way we wanted and design it. And on the inside are those shots of me in my front yard.
Oh, neat.
And yeah, Deborah's an amazing artist, by the way. She's right now is having a show of her art in Paris. So she's pretty incredible. You may want to check out DeborahDobkin.com.
So what types of music in your background have contributed to your style as it is now? How did you arrive to this point in your style?
Yeah, it's a big mishmash. I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. And, when I was little around our house, my dad listened to Dixieland. And that was his favorite music. We didn't play music in my house or anything. And then I remember Mitch Miller records. Remember those Mitch Miller records? Mm-hmm. Probably too young.
No, I know.
They were big sing-along records, and we used to like to sing along to those. Mm-hmm. But my first remembrance is early 60s sort of, this is going to sound crazy, surf rock. Mm. From I grew up in South Florida, but there was surf rock, and then there was the Beatles, and then it was Crosby, Stills and Nash and James Taylor, who are like big influences on me, especially James with his storytelling. I've tried to tell stories in my songs the best I can, but there were so many then. And then like Janis Joplin and Jefferson Airplane, I really kind of idolized these women lead singers. Then I studied some jazz also, jazz guitar, and I really enjoyed that. And I played in a big band in high school, which was really great. We had a concert band. I played bass clarinet, alto clarinet, and soprano sax and clarinet in that. That was a really great experience because we didn't have a marching band, so we were able to spend our time learning how to play our instruments and working on classical music. So that was a big influence to me because I read, and reading music was very important to me. Mm-hmm. And it's helped me in my writing. But I would say Bob Dylan, folk singers, you know, I missed the era of the beginning of the folk singers because I wasn't born during that time, or I was very small. But I picked up right there in the 70s when folk rock started kicking in. Cat Stevens, Jackson Browne, all of those people were huge influences on me. And I love to tell stories, and that's what I try to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are all great storytellers. So was your family musical, or were you just an anomaly as far as liking
exactly,
or playing instruments and things?
an anomaly. Yes. I think I'm the milkman's daughter. No, I'm just kidding. I used to tease my mom about that, though. No, we did not have, I was the only musician, and we didn't have a piano until after I begged for one. And I think we got it for my sister to learn to play, and I started taking some lessons. But my first instrument was just in like fifth grade, the recorder. I was in a recorder band, and I guess I had been musical as a kid. I loved singing and stuff, but that was kind of the first time I got to play something. And, you know, there's this story I like to tell. My mom took me to see Music Man at a local high school, Stranahan High School in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And I was 8 or 9 years old. And when we left, I was just like crying. And she said, "What's the matter? I thought you enjoyed it." And I said, "I did. I was so overwhelmed by, I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know kids could play the instruments in the orchestra and get up on the stage and act. And, you know, that was not part of my life growing up at all. We weren't show people." So that was the awakening right there. And I think my mom saw it. And then, you know, I started playing clarinet. And then my cousin Billy gave me this old guitar. And that was it. I was off. I was locked in my bedroom playing that guitar all the time. You know, my mother would say, "You have to come out and eat. Your fingers are bleeding." You know, just with these books, because I could read music, these like Ian and Sylvia, Bob Dylan songs. I didn't even know the melodies of them. I was learning the melodies by just playing them in this music. I'd never heard these songs before. So those versions were like my versions of these songs. And that was how I got started playing. And, you know, my parents never discouraged me and always let me make noise in the bedroom with my guitars and my clarinets and all that stuff. So that's I'm the musician in the family, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you have brothers, you said? A brother and...
I have a sister.
A sister. Okay.
You said... Yeah, my older sister. She played the piano for a while, but she didn't pursue that, no. She's a great mom and has had many different careers over time. She's my older sister. She's a pretty cool lady.
Uh-huh. And you said that you played guitar. You started playing guitar, and that was what, around 11, 12?
Yeah, about that age, I would go down to visit my cousin in Miami, and he had the guitar there, and I would just, like, you know, play on it and play on it and play on it. But I think right after that, around 11 or 12, yeah, maybe a little older, 12 or 13, he gave me this guitar, and I started playing. Yeah.
So at what point were you like, okay, I know how to play, I can play these songs on the guitar. What point did you think, hey, I can write songs on this guitar?
Well, songwriting came late for me, really. I didn't start writing until after college, and after I got to Los Angeles, I started writing. I played at coffee houses down in South Florida and stuff, and I was in a duo called Lauren and Lee, but we played covers. And I was concentrating so much on playing guitar that I wasn't really focusing on composing. So when I got to LA, I realized there were a million songwriters out here, and I thought, I'll try and write some songs. So I did. I was having some really strong feelings at the time, and so I wrote these songs, just started beginning. And I was working at Tower Records on Sunset Strip at the time, and another musician there, I can't remember his name now. Anyway, he helped me record on a little like 4-track, these demos, and I started going and hanging out at the Troubadour. It was the very end of the old Hoot Night that they used to have, the famous Monday night Hoot Nights. And I started playing there and opening for Billy and the Beaters, and I put a band together for a little while there. And that's when I started really writing songs. And that was 1978. Yeah.
Do you remember what the name of that first song was?
Don't Look Away.
Don't Look Away. And you know what it was? Was it a socially conscious song or
no?
No.
It was a love song. It was a breakup song, actually. Uh-huh. Not angry. It wasn't angry, but it was sad.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the touchstone of most of my songwriting, ladies and gentlemen. Sadness. It's a very strong emotion, and I think people kind of relate to it. But I know people want to hear happy songs also, I struggle to write happy songs. I will admit that now it's out in the open.
Yeah, I'm the same way. You know, because songwriting is a cathartic experience for me mm-hmm. as a songwriter. And so, you know, when I need to get something out, you know, usually happiness, you can express in a lot of different ways. But sadness, it's a very introverted kind of thing. And so songwriting is the way to do it, you know.
Yep, exactly. And, you know, I never start out to write what I'm writing. It just kind of happens. And, you know, most of my songs, I have to say, are all experiences based on experiences that I've had, mm-hmm. you know, or I'm going through at the time. It's really crazy. It's very kind of to say that it's kind of weird because you're like exposing yourself. But anyway, that's kind of what I do.
Yeah. Well, as a singer-songwriter, that's what you want to do. You just want to let people know who you are as a person and as an artist and to get to know you, you know.
Yeah, but as a crazy person who wants to just isolate, I don't want anybody to know.
No. Yeah. I always describe myself as an introverted extrovert, so.
Yeah, I kind of feel that way sometimes, too. Absolutely. Yeah.
Have you always written on the guitar, or you write on piano as well, or even the clarinet?
No, I always write on guitar. I wish I had played more piano. I bought a piano this year, and I've been trying to play it and trying to learn it, and because I do want to write on that. But no, I've never written anything on clarinet. That's a great idea, though. Mm-hmm. I got to dig my clarinet out. I have a lot of recorders laying around, and I mess around on those just to torture the cats a lot at home. Mm-hmm. They don't understand what I'm doing. You know, I noodle around on those. But most everything is written based on my guitar playing.
You said you really started at an open mic at the Troubadour. Were you playing in bands before that, or was it that just the launching of your singer-songwriter career?
No, I had played down in Florida in a duo, and we were working a lot. I went to Berklee College of Music in between there, and I played in a top 40 band. What were we called? Blackjack. While I was going to school there, I was the lead singer of that band, you know, with the blue satin jumpsuit and platform shoes and a shag haircut. It was pretty, if you can imagine. But that's the only band I had been in with, you know, as far as a band. But I was studying instrumental performance there because they only had two programs there. I don't know if you're familiar with Berklee College mm-hmm. of Music in Boston, yeah. But now it's this big, expansive. They have everything. They have vocal and recording and all kinds of stuff. But there they had instrumental performance and arranging and composition. So those were the two things. So I studied my guitar, and then I discovered this isn't really for me. I want to be a singer-songwriter, and they didn't really offer much more for me there. So I left and came, by the time I got to LA, I started playing solo. And then I had met some friends and created this little band. And two of them are in the band Long Riders, which had some success in the 80s. Sort of like a Birds tribute kind of band. Not a tribute band at all, but they played in that style. They were big fans of Gene Clark. Mm-hmm. And then I started working in singing background vocals. That kind of took over for a while. And, you know, life takes a lot of different paths. And I kind of got distracted there in the 80s for a while. And then in 1992, I started writing again. Started playing and writing again.
Mm-hmm. So the Troubadour, what was it like mm-hmm. when you were there back in the late 70s?
It was incredible. And it was, you know, I'm going to tell this story. My friend Susie Heffernan and I, we used to go every Monday night to hear Billy and the Beaters. And they had a bar right out front. It's changed physically a little bit. I don't know. I guess the bar's maybe still there. But it was like a cafe bar. And I remember getting up to go to the restroom. We were sitting out there talking to, I think his name is Keith Johnston, from the drummer from the Doobie Brothers, one of the drummers who she knew. And I got up and I went to the restroom. And I came back and I sat down and there was another woman there. And I just kind of turned to say hello. And I almost like gagged. It was Joni Mitchell. That's the kind of stuff that happened. You know, mm-hmm. So I sat and had my wine and tried to keep my cool with Joni Mitchell. And I like stepped on Glenn Frey's toe a couple of once coming out of the restroom in the main room. And it was just like it was still kind of a who's who in there. I'm sure there were people I didn't know. And I remember Andrew Gold being there. But you never knew who was going to jump up and play with Billy and his band. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's an amazing and quite accomplished songwriter. There are songs that you hear that he's written that you wouldn't even know he's written, but he's also an amazing singer and a guitarist. Mm-hmm. And a voiceover actor also. But he was like the biggest thing right then in 79. And he had a Monday night residency at the Troubadour with this giant band with horns. And it was just the coolest thing. That really sparked me. Joel, he works with the Folk Alliance. What is Joel's name? Why can't I remember his name? Anyway, he's the one that used to book me.
Oh, really?
He's the Far West coordinator last year, I think. Joel's going to kill me if he hears this. That's what happens when you get old. He used to book me on Monday nights there. We were both very young then. And I would just get up and do three songs before Billy and the Beaters, or I'd get my friends to come play bass and guitar with me. I never really had a drummer back then. And I would play three or four songs, and they gave me a little showcase a couple of times. It was just a really cool thing to be able to play there. It's totally changed now. It's not the same type of venue, but I kind of, once again, I come in on the tail end of something. Just born, I'm a baby boomer, but just born kind of in the middle.
Yeah. Well, at least you were there to see some of it, you know? I mean, that sounds exciting to...
Yeah. I sat out on the street and somebody told me, you got to get there because they only take the first three people. So I sat out on Santa Monica Boulevard from like 3 to 7 o'clock with my guitar, like all through rush hour and everything. It was crazy just to get my name in. And then like two people showed up after me and they're like, how long have you been here? You didn't have to. And I said, since 3. And they go, you know, we don't line up until 6. I was like, oh, well, I wanted to be first.
Well, that's the way you make sure the early bird gets the spot, right?
Right.
So tell me about, was this about the time, like shortly after this, that the American Music Circle started, or when did that
Americana
come about?
Music Circle started in 1998. And that was something I created so that I had a place to play every month. Because you struggle in Los Angeles to find places to play that aren't pay to play. Mm-hmm. So I started my own night. People were starting to open. Folk was kind of coming back, and people were starting to open coffee houses and things with live music, which hadn't been really happening before. And so I was at Hallenbeck's General Store. I had it there. I had it at Room 5. I had it at Kulak Woodshed. I had it at Genghis Cohen. It was a showcase for, of course, me and my music, but also for all my friends. So I would book 4 songwriters to sing in the round. I would open with my band, 4 singer-songwriters in the round, and then another band would close. And it was just a huge gathering of all kinds of people. I met so many really great songwriters and musicians here in Los Angeles through that.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. So how many years did you do that?
I did that up until about 2011. 2012? Yeah.
That's a good commitment for that. That's
It was a long time. It was a long time, and it was great. And we moved around, but, you know, as people, you have to change venues and stuff. And I would love to bring it back, but I just haven't found the right place yet. And if I do, I'll start my own night again. I do have a little house concert here at my studio in beautiful Reseda, California, in the summertime, called the Saturday Evening Social Club. We just wrapped up our season with Teresa James and Deborah Dobkin, Billy Watts, and Jennifer Condos. They're known as Queen Cake. It's an amazing band. So I open and I get to play.
So were the bands that you were using or in the performers, were they mostly in the folk genre or the Americana genre?
Yes. Americana is a kind of broad swipe. But they were in Americana or blues. I had some blues players too. Folk, country rock, that kind of thing, yeah.
I was looking at your bio and reading about some of the people that you've got to work with over the years. You got to work with Rita Coolidge and Leon Russell. What were those gigs like? What got you those gigs?
Well, one of my friends, Lynn Coulter, who plays drums with Rita Coolidge, and a bass player, Lynn Keller, who played bass with Rita Coolidge, had been playing with me, and they were like, we got to get you to open for Rita. And I was like, okay. So I was out in Joshua Tree playing a gig, and I heard Rita was out there. So Lynn called her, and we met, and we had dinner together over at her house. And she came to this coffee house to hear me play, which was nerve wracking. You know, she wanted to see whether I was legit or not. Mm-hmm. And then I opened for her at the Coach House we had almost the exact same band, except for keyboard player. No, I think I used her keyboard player too. So that was at the Coach House. And I remember walking out on the stage and almost fainting. It was kind of the first I had sung background for people and stuff in Vegas and been on big stages and everything. But this was like the first time I had played my original music with a band opening for people who came to see, like, they didn't come to see me. They came to see the wonderful Rita Coolidge. So it was funny. I was like rocking on my heels and like telling myself, do not pass out while I was singing my first song. So that was great. And she was really wonderful and she was very supportive. And that was a really fun gig.
Yeah,
the,
sounds like
the
it.
Leon Russell one. My friend Kilmo Doom, who owns Alligator Alley nightclub. This was a big nightclub in Plantation, Florida, and he had giant acts that came in there. And I was in town visiting for Christmas, and I always had my guitar with me. And I had also done a Go Girls Music Fest at this place, too, maybe a year, 5 years before that. But anyway, so I was there hanging out. And, you know, you would like to think that I was on tour and that I had, you know, extreme status in the world and was famous. And so I would be opening for this huge icon of somebody that I have almost all of his records. But it wasn't like that because the opening act forgot to show up.
Yeah.
So Kilmo, whose real name is Carl, Carl looks at me and he goes, do you have your guitar at your mom's house? I go, yeah. He goes, go get it. You're going to open for Leon Russell. And I'm like, okay. So I went and I got my guitar and I played like a full set and people were digging it. I just played solo by myself and played. I never even got to meet Leon Russell, unfortunately. But his band was great. It was a huge thing for me. But he kind of like took off on his little scamp. You know, those. he took off right after the gig. So yeah. I didn't really get to. And beforehand I was up on stage, but yeah, so that was pretty cool. So that doesn't make me famous or anything, but it was a really cool experience.
There are those situations of being in the right place at the right time.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It was cool. And it was awesome because he is an amazing songwriter and one of my favorites. I mean, there's an album that he did with Mark Benno called, The Asylum Choir. Two, I think it is. It was one of my favorite 8-tracks of my 68 Cougar that I listen to all the time.
That's
not
awesome.
To mention several other records, yeah.
So you've got a very loyal following. I was reading this story about your fan who came up to you after a show and showed you a tattoo they had done.
Yeah.
Can you tell us
that? That was a little freaky. Yeah, she tattooed some of the lyrics for Perfect Right Now, which was on my first CD. I met her out in, I believe, in Laughlin, Nevada, doing a parrot, like, you know, what do they call them? You know, parrot heads kind of gig. I was miscast in that gig.
Yeah.
I was kind of miscast in that gig, but I played a gig. I played the whole weekend there. I don't have pirate songs and and I don't play, like, you know, beach music, that kind of
margaritas.
Right. I don't really do that, but they were looking for some women to play. So my friend booked me on that show. And I met her there with her mom and she just loved that song, Perfect Right Now. And she kept asking me to play it over and they bought the CDs and everything. And we kind of kept in touch. And I think they came to see me here in LA a few times. I haven't seen her in a couple years. I think she's a little older and got her life going right now. But she sent me a picture, a JPEG, of her foot. She had it tattooed in her side of her foot. And it was still had, like, Vaseline on it. It was, like, brand new. And I was like, wow. Nobody's ever tattooed my lyrics on them before. So I was impressed with that and honored.
Yeah.
I think I was honored.
That's a painful place to get a tattoo.
I know. Yeah. But that was pretty interesting. I mean, that's like, wow. I didn't know my lyrics would affect anyone like that.
Yeah, so. That's got to make you feel good, though, too.
Yeah.
I mean, even though it's kind of freaky, it's still... It's nice to know your music touched somebody that way.
Yeah, it really did. It was special.
Speaking of which, Somewhere Else is an awesome CD. I really enjoyed listening to it and picking out the songs and getting into it. My favorite song on there, I think, is Baby You Drive. Can you tell people about that song?
Well, that's, you know, it's kind of a mishmash remembrance of growing up in South Florida. It's not my family, but it was another family. I'm not going to mention their name, but it was a family that I knew that it began with a remembrance of them. They grew up right on the Intercoastal Waterway. And these kind of really unique older Floridian houses, and their backyard was, they had a boat that's right on, I don't know if you're familiar with that part of the country, but there's an intercoastal waterway where there's houses built all on the canals and people have boats and they zip out to the ocean. And it was started with them. And then, you know, it's just kind of a personal feelings about a family. And as we get older, and the older I get now, you know, I've lost both of my parents recently in the last few years. And, you know, nobody tells you that when you get older, you start to lose people. So yeah. It's sort of like, you know, as the family went along and parents disappearing, but out of the picture, but still having strong bond with your brothers and sisters, and how beautiful it was on Bayview Drive. So I don't know if that explained it, but it was sort of a melancholy kind of feeling of all those emotions.
Yeah. Yeah. It really spoke to me because I've lost both my parents and a couple of brothers as well. And so, it really hit me when I listened to it. Can you also talk about the song Seminole Wind? Tell us about that song.
Yeah, that was written by the great John Anderson, who I saw was on tour again. Yay! He's the most distinct voice and such a great country writer. He wrote that song about the Everglades and the Seminole lands that were encroached on. It was back in the 80s, and oil people came and they dug up the land and sucked the Everglades dry and just left it. So I have always been attracted to that song. I know James Taylor covered it too. He did a little different version. Lots of people have covered that song, but it just has always spoken to me. I try to write or have something about my roots in Florida and on each record. But I heard that song as a really heavy kind of rock song. I told my producer, can we get Neil Young and Crazy Horse to come in and play on that? But we made it sound like that anyway, but that was my feeling of it, that I wanted to do that. And that's a very close thing to me. I mean, Osceola was a very famous Seminole Indian. It was said that he was imprisoned in St. Augustine, and they said and I've been to this fort, and they said he starved himself to slide through the windows, which were maybe the width of 4 or 5 inches, so that he could escape, and that he escaped Fort, is it Sumter? No. I can't remember what the fort is now. See, there it goes. Another brain cell lost, but it's in St. Augustine. He's mentioned in the song too. And luckily, the Seminole Indians have now preserved their rights and their lands there, and I think they own the entire Hard Rock system now. It's beautiful land out there. Last time I was out there, going out down Alligator Alley, I saw a Florida panther like running. They have these big tubes. They look like drainage tubes, but the animals use them to run, go under the highway. Mm-hmm. And I saw one just run under there.
Wow. Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah, it was really cool. People think that alligators are like walking around, you know, said, people say, you're from Florida. Aren't you afraid of all those gators? And I'm like, what? Do you think they're like walking down the street attacking people? It's not like Sharknado.
They should do an alligator version of that.
Alanado.
Yeah.
Gatornado, that's what it should be.
Gatornado, yeah. So another song I like a lot is the first track on the CD, It Takes What It Takes. What's that song about?
Well, that's a fighting for love song. You know, we'll do what it takes to keep us alive and keep our love strong. And it's sort of written about people who are not allowed to love who they want to love, who've had a hard time with that. And that's what that song is about, fighting for love and not letting anyone take it away from you.
Yeah, we need to just play that song a lot more now.
Cool.
Your producer on this CD was Nick Kurgo. How did you get him to work with you on this CD?
Nick Kurgo and I have been friends a long time, and this is the second CD he's produced for me. I think we met in, geez, it must have been 98, maybe, 1998. He was playing with Deborah Davis, another great songwriter from Los Angeles. Right after I played, he played. And I remember he came up to me and he said, that was really good. And then he went up on stage and he started playing and I went, oh my God, that's the guy I've been looking for. Because I had been looking for a guitarist to play with me and work with me. And I got his number, and we've been playing together ever since. And he's an amazing musician, great ear, and he gets what I want to do on these songs. He hears what I want, and he helps me get there. We collaborate. We produce this together, and we spent many hours together playing. And I can trust him on stage when I make mistakes to follow me.
That's important.
And, yeah, which is really important. And he's just he's a good friend and a very talented musician and producer.
You also have a lot of other great musicians on the CD as well. A lot of them are veteran musicians who know what they're doing. How much direction do you give someone who's accomplished as some of the people that you work with?
That's a great question. Very little, because they ask me what I want and then they deliver. Pretty much. I remember a long time ago, I'm not going to say this bass player's name, but on my first record, he played something. He was replacing a bass player that I had played on it originally. And we stopped and I said, "Oh, that was fantastic. Do you remember what you just did?" And he looked at me with this like resting anger face.
Bitch face.
Yeah, I didn't want to say that, but resting bitch face, and said, "Oh, you found my weak spot. I don't remember anything," you know, and then he played it right away. And I was like, wow, I'm sorry. I was very naive, I guess, that I should have just said, could you play that again? But I got excited. I didn't know that I couldn't, you know, I apparently had insulted him. But anyway, that has stuck in my head for a long time. So I learned how to speak to musicians a little differently. But these guys like Mark Pocket Goldberg and Deborah Dobkin and Dave Frazier, they know, they've been playing with me a long time too, live. And they know when I say what I want, they ask questions. And, you know, I don't remember having to be specific about anything, except maybe with Dave Frazier on the accordion part on Oh Marie, but I trust them. Trust them with my life. I don't know if they'd all take a bullet for me, but yeah. They ask me questions, I give them an answer, and if I say one word, you know, I usually answer with one word answers, and they get it.
Yeah.
That's just good. From spending time together, you know, and playing together. You learn what each other like.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of trust that goes into that, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Are you going to be touring with the CD?
I am in the springtime. I have we're working on going up the Northwest, going up the coast from California, Washington, Oregon. I don't have anything specific. I'm sorry, you guys, I can't tell you right now, but we're working on a plan for that in the springtime.
That'd be great. So are there any of the projects you're working on, or are you just concentrating on the CD right now?
Well, I'm in the beginning stages of not recording, but conceptualizing and getting songs ready for a new acoustic CD. I think it's going to be acoustic. I'm not going to have big instrumentation on it, so I don't know what kind of rhythm instruments we'll be using, but it's going to be mostly acoustic instruments.
And these going to be original songs?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Right. Great.
Definitely.
So the new CD is called Somewhere Else by Lauren Adams. You can get it at CD Baby through your website as well, which is probably the place you want to go first, right?
Yeah, if you want to know about me, yeah. You can see that. It's also available on iTunes.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. So here's my last question for you, and it's sort of my James Lipton type question.
Okay. Oh. My favorite curse word.
No, we won't do that. What's your favorite song by someone else and why?
Oh, my God. That is so hard. I should have a pat answer for this. I've been asked this before. Oh, my goodness. That's not fair. let me see. I'll tell you. You know, there's so many great songs. You can't ask a songwriter that. I'm such a fan of so many different kinds of music. But one that I always loved the most, and when I was learning to play guitar, I learned every single note of this and every single finger picking thing on the song Blossom by James Taylor. And that is one of my favorite acoustic music songs. I don't know. It's on Sweet Baby James. But I'm sure I'm going to call you up later and go, "No, it's this song. No, it's this song." I mean, there's so many beautiful songs in the world. I you know, that's the one that comes to mind that I am most fond of right now.
Yeah.
Just say that. That's the hardest question. I got to come up with some kind of answer because I've been asked that before and just gone,
Yeah.
You know, I also love A Case of You by Joni Mitchell. That's one of my favorite songs ever.
Mm-hmm.
So
I've heard other people say that one too. So, yeah. Everybody, at least one out of every four people say a Joni Mitchell song. So.
Oh, really? Yeah. Cool. Well, yeah. I'm in good company then.
Yeah. A lot of, she's had such an amazing influence on singer-songwriters, and she's one of a kind.
Definitely.
So once again, I want to tell everybody your website is laurenadams.com. It's LaurenAdams.com. And you can pick up the CD there, and you can also find out more about Lauren. Are you going to be doing any videos for any of the songs on this?
There is a video for Something Else. It's on the website, too. You can check that out. I shot it on my iPhone.
All right, great. That's cool.
It came out amazingly well. I was very happy with that. And there's stock footage in there, but it's mostly shot on my iPhone. So I had a great time doing that. You know, us indies, we're on a budget.
Right.
So, yeah. So I shot it on my iPhone.
Very good.
And Kathy, I want to say to you, thank you for all that you do for all of us indies. You have a great radio station going there. Your interviews are wonderful. You've interviewed a lot of my friends, and it's great to have a fan like you and someone helping us to get exposure and be out there in the world with our music.
Well, that's no problem. It's my pleasure. I get as much joy out of it as you do. So
excellent. Yeah. That's what we want, joy.
Exactly. We've been speaking with Lauren Adams. The name of her new CD is called Somewhere Else. You can pick it up at her website or on CD Baby, iTunes, all those regular sites where you can pick up great music. So thanks again, Lauren, and we'll be chatting with you soon.
See you soon.